This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello and welcome to this Series 3, Episode 10 of Out with Susie Ruffle. Thank you so much for listening. You might be someone that's been listening since the start. Hello, you might be someone that's come to this episode because you're a massive fan of Hannah Gadsby. Either way, you're totally welcome. Thanks for coming along. I'm really excited to share this episode today. Thank you so much to all of you that got in touch last week after Broner's episode. It seemed that it really hit a chord with loads of people. So, yeah, Broner and I were both really blown away by it. We were texting lots of the day saying how lovely it was that so many people had shared it and talked about it. And I got some really gorgeous emails as well. So thank you so much. If you do want to get in touch with me, you always can. The email is hello@outwithsusieruffle.com. I said hello then, like you can put intonation in an email. But if you do email me, I hope that you think that as you type it. hello@outwithsusieruffle.com. There's been lots of messages and emails and tweets and Instagrams and people commenting on the podcast apps. And I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so, so much. Rating and reviewing the podcast always helps. I know that you hear that on all of your podcasts, but it does. So I have to mention it as well. As always, we start our episodes with listener emails. I always want to say listener letters. I've not got a post bag. Listener letters. So let's share a couple of those before we get into our interview. Hello, Susie. I hope you've been enjoying the sunshine and pub gardens and barbecues and all the delights as the relaxing of rules here in the UK begins. I also apologise for the length of this. It's taken me a few weeks to get up the confidence to finally message my gratitude in response to both your amazing podcasts, especially your episode with the truly wonderful Jessica Foster Q. That is a particularly brilliant episode. If you haven't listened to it, I strongly advise you do. I started listening to Like-Minded Friends, that's the podcast I do with Tom, because I adore both you and Tom, and during lockdown one, just needed some friendly voices. I found out as a result and began to follow and listen to other people and podcasts after discovering them through you, building a bigger picture of sexuality as I went, and telling myself and others I'm just being an ally. I spent the past few months, or let's face it, years, feeling increasingly like something wasn't quite right. I've never been able to put my finger on it. More recently, I could pass it off to myself as the tiredness of small children or being touched out due to small children. This is a real thing and I don't want to undermine it. And I assumed I'd get some sort of sex drive back eventually, and I have. And this has become clear. Everything started to click. The more I heard, the more I discovered I wasn't just listening as an ally, I was listening for myself. For answers I hadn't realised I was so desperately in need of. The intense female friendships, the feelings I was experiencing were totally normal, and then hearing Jess's honest and sincere account of her experience led me to stand in my kitchen alone and sob. The pieces of my carefully constructed identity in life came crashing down, and it was like someone had looked inside my mind and put to words exactly how I felt. I've been sitting ever since the episode aired with the realisation that as well as being bi, I very much have internalised homophobia. I have children, I'm married to a man. It's going to be a very slow and steady process of unpicking myself and putting myself and my life back together again with the least amount of heartbreak. But I now know who I am and I know that I can do it. I mentioned to two very dear friends in our first socially distanced meetup how I felt, and instantly they were supportive, reassuring, and quickly made me see that they will love me and support me no matter what. All of this, my realisation and my confidence to approach my friends with some more much needed handholding, is because of you. I can't put into words how important your podcast is to me and countless others across the globe. Because of you, I can see that we're not alone. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. For obvious reasons, I'm going to keep that email anonymous. That's the word I'm looking for, anonymous. Thank you so much for saying that. It's really lovely that the podcast has meant that much to you. And I think Jess's episode is really special. And I think it's as I've said before, I'm the person that gets to interview people, but it honestly is so many people sharing their stories with me that it is the reason that this podcast is getting those sorts of responses. So thank you so much for taking the time to email me, and good luck with whatever comes next for you. It's really lovely when people say that the podcast has meant a lot to them. Obviously, it means an enormous amount to me. There's nothing that I've ever done in my professional life that feels more important than those emails that I receive. And I was talking to my girlfriend today. We were on our way back from a socially distanced barbecue with some friends. And I knew that I had to do this intro to this episode. And my girlfriend said to me, that podcast has really saved you over the last year. And I think it really has, because it was so strange for me with comedy just disappearing off the face of the earth. And I love doing stand-up. It's my favourite thing in the world to do. And it's the only thing I've ever been good at. So I get such a kick out of doing it. And having something to do, feeling like I'm talking to people and sharing these stories, has just been such a joy for me over the last 12 months when my job just stopped existing. So it's so lovely when people say how much they appreciate the podcast, but I guess I really appreciate all of you listening to it as well. God, for people that have just come to this episode for Hannah Gadsby, it feels like it's very heavy. I promise it's not, guys. I sound like I'm having quite an emotional time, but I've actually just had a lovely day. Okay, let's share another email. Hi, Susie. I've been thinking about sending you an email for quite some time. The listener emails are my favourite part of the podcast for me. There's lots I could share, but nothing has felt quite as pertinent until now. For context, I retrained as a primary school teacher a few years ago and have been doing my best to make my classrooms as embracing, inclusive and an open environment, because as a queer brown woman who has experienced mental health issues, I know firsthand what a difference being accepted can make and how awful it can feel when you're somewhere where you feel othered. I've had lots of beautiful moments with children, but none have impacted me in the same way as a moment I had with a child this week. I teach 7 to 8 year olds, and I read a story called King and King, where two princes get married. And although I've shared quite a few queer stories, and we've talked a fair bit about being gay and about different family structures, etc., some kids said, when there was a kissing pic at the end of the story. To be fair, kids say, at anyone kissing, but I didn't want to let this teaching moment pass me by. So I asked the kids to share why they thought it was and it was a good discussion to have. I explained that the response could be hurtful for someone, and we might not even realise, because there might be times when there are people in the room who haven't told us they're gay, and the kids seem to really get it. At the end of the day, a kid came up to me and said, I felt a bit sad when the other kid said because I'm gay. I told him that I felt a bit sad too, because I'm also gay. I've not explicitly come out to my class because I'm not sure how supportive my school will be if any of the parents have an issue with it. Part of this is definitely a hangover of working with people who work during Section 28. I explained to him why the kids might have said that, and it didn't mean that being gay was bad, and that sometimes we have to learn to look after ourselves when people upset us like that. I asked him if he was able to chat to any of his friends, and when did he realise? He said he realised at the weekend and told a friend in our class the day after. I told him he could chat to me whenever he wanted and left it fairly casual, as I wanted him to have the experience of an adult simply accepting it without causing a huge fuss in either a positive or a negative way. Even though I kept my response fairly casual, I'll obviously follow it up and keep checking in with him to see if he needs support in anything, including telling others if he wants to. I've since found out that I was the first adult he's told, and I'm blown away that he trusted me enough to tell me. Oh my heart. I have no idea how his life will go, but I hope that seeing himself reflected in our classroom has helped him and will continue to help him. I can only hope that he'll be able to hold on to the acceptance I've given him at those points when he might face that negativity. It makes my heart hurt to think of those who've had negative early experiences of sharing our sexuality, but I'm also happy to be a small positive part in this young person's journey. For me, teaching children to be accepting, kind and reflective is far more important than covering the curriculum. And creating an environment where kids can feel seen and accepted is the ultimate joy. I felt so emotional after this kid came out to me. It feels so important, powerful and healing to see this small human be able to understand himself a little better and feel safe enough to share it. I'm not sure when I discovered your podcast, but I binge listened and have shared it with so many straight and queer friends alike, because the power of these stories is so immensely healing. So I wondered if any of your listeners knew of any similar podcasts where kids or young people have shared their stories, because I think it could be really important for this kid and other queer kids to understand themselves better. I'll sign off now with a thanks for creating the podcast and sharing the stories. They're really helping me feel more connected and seen too. and I'll keep that one anonymous too. Wow, I wish you were my teacher. I mean, I imagine we're a similar age, or you might even be younger than me, but what a wonderful experience for this boy. What a brilliant teacher you are. If anyone does have any recommendations for podcasts, I don't know any offhand, but if anyone does have any recommendations for stories, sort of queer stories about younger people, let me know and email me, and I'll send them across to this brilliant teacher. Thank you so much for getting in touch. I really appreciate it. Okay, let's get to today's episode. It's the marvellous Hannah Gadsby. I've known Hannah for quite a few years. I've always thought she was brilliant. You can hear that I'm kind of fangirling for a lot of the episode, which I think makes Hannah quite uncomfortable. But I think this is a brilliant conversation. I think this is a bit of a special one. I really hope you enjoy it. Listener, I am very excited for today's conversation. The guest today is actually someone that was on my list when I first started the podcast nearly a year ago, so I'm just so chuffed that she is that she's talking to me today. Hannah Gadsby is a phenomenal stand-up comedian. I first saw her at the Edinburgh Fringe in 2013 and have been a fan ever since. Her shows are always funny, thought-provoking, and smart. She's been nominated for pretty much every comedy award going at festivals across the globe. And in 2017, I saw her show Nanette in Edinburgh in a small, packed lecture theatre that was so little, it was kind of like a studio. And I was utterly blown away. It was an incredible piece of work, and it had already won Best Show at the Melbourne Comedy Festival and soon won Best Show at the Fringe. And it was so much more than a stand-up show and created a conversation about what stand-up could be. After that show, I felt like for me and for so many comedians I know, it inspired us to rethink how we put together a show, to rethink how we look at what we do. Nanette then toured the world and recorded a special for Netflix. It went on to win a Primetime Emmy for Outstanding Writing in a Variety Special and a Peabody Award. Her second Netflix special, Douglas, is just as brilliant, and it is a true joy to welcome her to the podcast today. Hello, Hannah.
Wow. Hello. I sound pretty cool. I was reminded of, but Edinburgh Fringe is not my time to shine as a human being because it's
horrible.
Overwhelming. And you meant it was 2013. So I think
Naked Nudes?
Yeah.
Is that the show?
Yeah, it was a good show, that one.
It was a good show, mate. Yeah.
Yeah, I enjoyed doing that show. But yeah, I think a few years later, I think it definitely was 2015-16, I was diagnosed with autism, and then I realized why I became such a it was difficult for me to be in Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I think half the comedians of that world must think I'm an asshole. Because I was just getting through it, because it was just so overstimulating, and I'd be all right in the first week, and then I'd be just slowly crushed. And it wouldn't matter if I was having a good run or not. It was just crushing.
Like the exhaustion of it?
Yeah, because there's so many people, so much touching.
Yeah, there is a lot of that.
So much touching and so much, like, just so many emotions other people are having.
Yeah. And they're so willing to share them.
So willing to share it. And it's like, not that I don't care, it's just a lot. Because everyone's putting their hearts and dreams and, you know, all this writing on the Edinburgh Fringe. And everyone's devolving at the same time. And I'm just there going, I don't like the sound of cobblestones.
And so Edinburgh's not a good place for you because there is a lot of cobbles.
There's just the environmental factor of Edinburgh gets to me before even the reality of putting on a show.
I think the thing is with Edinburgh is that you're always walking uphill. Somehow I would walk uphill to my venue and then uphill home. I'm like, how is this? Yeah. This doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
It's always effort. Do you feel the same about Melbourne Comedy Festival?
No, because there's a hometown advantage of Melbourne. Mm. Then there's also the fact that it's only at night. It's not all day. Yeah. Like you can walk out. Like there are places where I live in Melbourne, it's not the festival, it's just right in the centre of the city, whereas Edinburgh, that's it. Like, and so you can't go anywhere without seeing other people's faces on a poster.
That is true.
Like you're surrounded by professional jealousy.
And as the festival goes on, people will consistently put stars up and great quotes.
And I never did that. And I never got, because I was just like, I couldn't, it was enough for me to just be able to get out the door and get on stage. And without, like, you know, if you're not supported by a big team there, it's just like, I'd have 5-star reviews and my posters be empty. Because I'm just like, I can't. So I get glue. I don't want to get glue on my hand. Gross.
I mean, in more recent years, getting a ticket for your show, I mean, it's not like you had to try to sell it. I remember having to book more recent ones like weeks in advance before the festival.
Yeah, it's sort of like I'm not a good measure of the kind of tenacity that, you know, like I wouldn't say follow my model to people. Because it's like you just be, the festival would be just full of these sort of partially mute blobs just miserying themselves around the festival. It would no longer be a festival.
But having some really like hot whip smart takes on some paintings from the 1700s.
Yeah, inside the show's fine, but then you go out and go, who died?
Do you feel like that even now getting on stage? Because I watched Douglas again before doing this. I'd already watched it once ages ago. But I watched
it's a good
it
show,
again.
Isn't it?
It's a really good show, mate. It's a really good show.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with that show.
What have you done with the dog Crayon?
He's just out in the lounge. We've got him crated over. And then we use the crate that he came in as I use it for a linen press.
Why not?
I put some hinges on it and some caster wheels and just wheel it in. Where do I need to make a bed next?
Wow.
Yeah,
locked
out.
I love the sound of your life.
It's pretty good.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
But do you still feel like that now, like getting on stage? Do you feel stressed beforehand? Like, are you still... I guess you were saying it's mainly in Edinburgh that you've got that sort of energy.
No, like, the stress for me was never getting on stage. For some reason, what is a deficit in other parts of my life is a positive on stage. I don't get nerves. I don't catastrophize the possibilities. I just go into a nice, comfy little zone and talk to my audience. Of course, if the audience is not an, you know how sometimes an audience will have a team meeting and go, we don't want to like this person, and it's nothing. But my mind is like, I don't get desperate. I don't go, well, I'm going to win you back. I go, let's just finish this early so no one remembers it. Because I see that mistake all the time with comics, is they're like, I'm going to win this over, and it just gets worse.
Yeah, I've made that mistake for sure. I'm such a people pleaser.
Yeah, and so that is not what happens to me. I just sort of go, well, you win some, you lose some. Like, you know, I know all the tricks and I can sometimes get, you know, back, but I don't try too hard.
I love that.
So I don't get the nerves. I don't. Sometimes I stand side of stage and just go, who are you? What do you want from me? Why? And
well, I love that sort of what you say at the top of Douglas when you're like, why are you here? It's like some massive theatre in that shot in New York.
Yeah, it was in there. I think that was in LA. Sorry, LA. It was.
Oh, LA, right, yeah. And so in a huge theatre, just berating your audience for coming out.
It's just genuine curiosity. When I did when I did Nanette in New York, I that was when I really, Nanette became something I'd never known before. Before that, I was just doing Nanette in all the places I'd already done my other shows for 10 years. So there was that Nanette was always, until I did it in New York, was always in a context that I'd spoken to my audiences before. So I felt like, but that was new altogether. I was just telling people who'd never even looked sideways at me that I was quitting comedy. So it became a different thing altogether. But anyway, so I was getting like standing ovations at the end of this show, which is like on paper and in person, exciting. Mm-hmm. But that show's not really a victory lap kind of fucking show, sorry. And so I'd go walk off stage at the end of the show, I'd get this standing ovation, and I'd just leave them. And after about a week of this, the producers had to come out and they're like, you got to come back out. And I'm like, why? They want more. And I'm like, I've said everything. And they're like, no, but they're clapping. I said, what do they want from me? I've done my job, they're clapping, they can do what they need to do. I don't need to be involved in this. And it was just like, it's really long. I in hindsight, I can see that I was being torturous, but just the logic of it just wouldn't go into my head. And I'm just like, no, I don't. I did the show. They paid for the show. What they do afterwards is their business. And
you're like arguing what every other stand-up's dream is to be like, oh, I guess I have to go back out.
Pretty much. Like, and I don't, I'm not telling you this to go, say, I'm cool. It's just like the logic of it didn't, until someone eventually convinced, you know, made it, they're like, they want to, it's for them. That was the thing. It's like, so I'm like, all right, I'll do it for them. So they want to show, you know, like it's this, because I always thought it was just like, you know, just performers being wankers going, oh, give me a bit more, give me a bit more. It's just like, get off. Most of the time we're just clapping because we're supposed to.
Yeah, because we're like, oh, okay, I can get dinner now.
Yeah, stop drinking this up. This is not your elixir.
So did you then have to write a new bit to go on and close with?
Mm-mm. No, they just want me to go back and just bow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and just, it's just, you know.
Not an encore, just a second.
Just a bow, which I'm just like, oh, God, I'm tired. No, but the other thing about that, though, is that it is, isn't it, is a thing that goes with trauma, and it's very difficult to absorb positive affectation. Mm-hmm. You know, so it goes beyond the logic of it. It's just like, it just felt a lot.
Yeah, well, I can imagine that. Yeah, I remember after seeing the show in Edinburgh, I was like, usually I would stick around to say to the stand-up, that was great, or, you know, like, oh, nice to see you, you want to go and have a drink? I was like, I'll bump into her. I'll bump into her and tell her I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, tripping over the cobblestone somewhere.
I read in an article today, actually, that was from back when you, I think it was written when you were in New York, and you said that you felt like you were living somebody else's dream.
Yeah. I still feel like that in a way, and it's not because I don't know why, but I've never been able to dream, you know, like, I kept saying that, you know, when this was happening, they're like, all the doors are open for you now. And in my mind, all I could see was just me opening doors and nothing inside. Like, I just don't know what that meant. Like, and I know that, like, you know, most people I know, you know, all my friends in comedy, it's like they're always got the sitcom pitch in their head, you know, and I just didn't have one ready. So I was having all these meetings and I'm like, oh, it was true. That show really was everything I had and I chucked it at it. So, and because it was so exhausting to perform, I had nothing. So I was taking these meetings like, what do you want to do? And I'm like, go to bed.
Because you must have done it for like a year. That must have been exhausting to do that
18,
show.
18 months.
18 months, fucking hell. That is such a long time
it's
to
too
do.
Too long. It's too long.
Like,
it did damage.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine.
And what's interesting to me is most people know that show as being the text that is on Netflix. But what it did to me was 18 months every night in front of a live audience. Like, my understanding of what that show is different to what the world is going to take away from it. And that's fine, but it is just an interesting thing.
Did you have a big break afterwards?
Not big enough.
Really?
No, I got a book deal.
Oh, yeah, of course. Is it 10 Steps?
Yeah, that's what it's called, but is it?
No. Yeah.
No, you know, you pitch an idea and then you go, that was a dumb idea. I'm not going to do that. So I'm just finishing that up at the moment. I've been writing it for a very long time. I got a book deal 10 years before I got the second book deal. It just rolled into the next one. I'm like, I've always had a story in him before Nanette. Like, there's a good yarn there. But I just, it's really, really difficult to find a cohesive line through trauma. And because my brain works the way it does, I can't make it up. Like, so I'm there just like, well, that didn't happen. That's not how I felt. And I know that's the easiest way to get the vibe of what happened and how I felt across. But my mind's going, it's not true. And that's the black and white autistic brain at work there. And so I've got these gaps in my memory that I guess were part of self-preservation. And whereas other parts of my life, it's just like, it's like I'm, you know, it's an archive. The sort of archive your dad puts together and it's just really boring. Why'd you keep this detail? It's not relevant. So I've got to sort through all that shit to get a story out. And the page is just so much more permanent than the stage, you know, like this. And you just got to be really careful with your story, because it's then becomes part of not just how other people see you, but how you see yourself. And then there's a, you know, like, and I'm actually genuinely frightened of doing, like, of writing the wrong story. And the reason I know that it's possible is that, you know, the way I saw myself and my story changed so radically over a 3-year period. That it was just like, if I'd written my story before that, maybe I'd, you know, put a lid on things. But, you know, having said that, that's a healing process. If you can put a story around something, it can button up and heal.
Mm. And it must have been, obviously, like, within the comedy community, everyone was talking about it, but then it became this massive thing that, like, on Twitter it was, like, huge, and people that I know that, like, aren't into comedy at all, like, have you seen this? Like, of course I've fucking seen it. Like, but, like, everyone. And so it became this sort of public discourse. And so I suppose that now you know that can happen with a show that you sort of went, well, I'm going to give up comedy, so I'm going to do this and take it to a few festivals and then maybe do something else. And then it's sort of, you know, all of these articles are written about it and all these famous people are tweeting about watching it. It must have been... Did it still feel like it was you, or did it feel like you were sort of observing it?
I couldn't follow. After a certain amount of time, I couldn't keep following it.
Yeah.
Someone wisely said to me, especially after the Netflix special dropped, it's mm-hmm. like, you know, the thing about a fast-flowing river, you don't have to be in it to know it. Like, you just can know that the river's going really fast.
Yeah.
Because I was getting very disorientated by the attention.
Yeah.
And you know, and I'm not, and I know it's, I can say quite confidently, it's got nothing to do with being humble. It's quite literally because it was painful. Because positive, it doesn't matter what the attention is. Attention is difficult for me.
And were you like that when you were like a kid?
Yeah. I haven't changed. I just haven't altered. This just used to be this little matter of fact, grumpy little kid. Just going, that doesn't make any sense. Okay, bye.
So when you, because I know that you grew up in Tasmania, what was that like? What does that look like for someone that's never been to that part of the world?
Sort of, it's similar where I was on the northwest coast, because I think most people's idea of Australia is like beaches and, you know, mm-hmm. where the blonde people prepare for Hollywood.
Right, okay.
So many of
them. Yeah, but I've done the road show, so I've seen all
you know
parts of Australia.
Yeah, you get it.
So, I've played Broken Hill.
Yeah, never was a hill. Where I'm from in Tasmania sort of has, I think it's sort of got a lot in common with, like, Ireland.
Oh, okay.
And the Appalachian. You know, like,
okay,
there's a little bit of ring-a-ding-ding, but they're happy with it, you know what I mean? A lot of potatoes. And, you know, where I was growing up, it was like you had two hobbies to choose from, sport or drugs.
Okay.
And the really talented ones could do both.
Yeah, I was about to say, did anyone dabble in the two?
Yeah, I chose sport.
Was it 1997 that homosexuality was decriminalised in Tasmania?
Yeah.
Was it as late as that?
Yeah, and the thing about that being a date is sort of only ever considered as that. Because it's, and then people just like, oh, it was decriminalised in this place at that time. Most of the times when homosexuality was decriminalised, it was just sort of like this hot moment, and sometimes it was just gone, well, this is clearly something we should change. But what happened in Tasmania was that it was a 10-year debate, a 10-year very toxic and public debate. And on an island where it's just really small and everyone knows everyone. So it was a really, really harmful and horrible place to grow up in the closet.
Mm. And what age would you have been in 97?
19.
That's like a really formative time.
That is the formative time.
Yeah.
So I went into that 10 years not knowing that homosexuality existed. And the first thing I understood about homosexuality was that homosexuals are the spawn of the devil and spread disease, because it was, of course, coincided with the AIDS crisis.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, the first thing I sort of absorbed were that gay men were pedophiles with disease. Mm-hmm. And, you know, lesbians were just, didn't even get a story.
Mm. That must have been awful. I think that because there's an amount of shame for me. But, you know, I didn't grow up, you know, it wasn't illegal. It was just frowned upon, or something that my mum and dad would be like, not homophobic, but sort of casually use slurs to describe people. And even just that sort of made me carry like a backpack of shame.
Yeah.
Into like my mid-30s.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the problem. And like the debate didn't invent, you know, these attitudes. It just amplified it. So I think...
Mm.
And it's sort of what you see, say, in the United States at the moment, even in the UK, is just like that wedge issue that shouldn't even really be a wedge issue, but suddenly becomes that. My understanding of myself and my sexuality at no point was nice. I don't even remember getting like that like excited feeling. Like I just never had it.
And so did you not come out? Was it just not an option?
It was beyond that. It was just like I was so deeply closeted. I didn't know I had to come out. Like it just didn't seem to be an option. Like so, you know, and it sort of helped that I was not like a magnet for boys. So it's just not like I was never really confronted like with a decision. It was just, you know, suppression.
Yeah. And was it when, because I know, did you go over to, do you call it the mainland?
Yeah.
That's what I want to call it. You do call it the mainland.
Yeah. So the issue, I think, and I don't talk about it in the net because there's already so much that I had to talk about in an app, was that what the compounding factor, though, was for me was the autism of it. Because, you know, there's this strong idea in the queer community that, you know, you find your family, and that's what's helped us survive and, you know, mm-hmm. and have a culture. But when you have autism, you don't find family that easily. You're not wired that way. You're wired to be an outcast, which... And you're quite happy with that to a certain extent. People with autism can't afford to reject their family.
I've never thought of that. Yeah.
You know, and it's just another layer of vulnerability. I can't navigate, like I just don't have the ability to navigate the administration of life. So, you know, I talk a good game, but I can't fill in a form, you know, so I... So I've at times in my life I've been homeless because I haven't been able to navigate the bureaucracy of you know, getting a phone, paying rent.
How was that then when you were like all of a sudden this like world touring stand-up? Like I know it didn't go from you, you know, not having somewhere to live to that, but like is it because you just think, well, I do the show and everything else can just be sorted out?
Yeah. Yeah, like I don't know what's happened to me. Like I think what's interesting is that I think, you know, so many of the people who now know who I am, that's all they know of me. And it's a weird line to walk because you know, I don't want to become Ellen. You know, you don't want to
get a chat show. Come on, Hannah.
No, I'm
putting effort in. I'm, get a bloody chat show.
I'm more talking about going to the
no, I don't.
Going to baseball with George Bush and not knowing why that's an issue. Like, I don't want to become that person.
Yeah, no.
Like, okay, just okay. Like, yeah, but some of my friends wear fur. And it's like, what you're saying is all your friends are rich and you don't care.
Yeah, sure.
But, so I'm hyper aware of that. And there's a sense of shame about being comfortable during the pandemic. Because I can't just help but think, it's like, if that had happened a little while ago, I probably would have died. I wouldn't, you know, if I'd have been on my own, I wouldn't have been able to know, you know, been able to navigate the forms in order to help me pay rent or, you know, these sorts of things. Like I now have management for that. But really what I have is special needs and I'm getting the help I should have always had.
Mm.
So I have a really uneasy relationship with people doing things for me because on the outside it looks like, oh, you know, you're a spoiled performer. And it's just like, I can't do that. I don't know how to talk to people.
But that's so good that you, I mean, this is going to sound ridiculous, but it's so good that you talk about that, or like that those things are now being said aloud, because you're absolutely right. Like it's not something that's taught in schools. Like, oh, this is how you actually exist as an adult. Like, here's some life skills. Like, oh no, instead we're going to learn about some shit that happened forever ago that's all from a man's point of view.
The irony of our education system is that it's taught. It seems like it's been designed by someone with autism. That is the irony of it. It's like, memorize this fact. Which is a deeply, deeply comfortable thing for me to do. I love facts. I love memorizing them.
Well at school?
No. No.
You can leave that there. Go on.
Yeah. No.
No. Okay.
There was a lot going on.
Sure.
There's a lot going on. Plus I had, you know, trouble at school because of it was the stress of being, you know, the social aspect of it. It's one of the things about girls on the spectrum that's not really the reason why we're not diagnosed, and that is because, and it's a really interesting space, and I think it's worth talking about because there's this and it's like, oh, girls don't have autism like boys do. And I don't know if that's necessarily true, but I do know we can't afford to have autism like the boys have, you know. So I think there's a point, you know, it depends where you're situated on the spectrum. If I could have felt like I could have just sat in a corner and thought about whatever I wanted to think about, I may not have struggled as much as I did, because what I had to spend all my energy on was not being tormented by my peers. Mm-hmm. Like, because girls have a different social bar. Like, and I still don't understand. I'll be there with, you know, three people who I genuinely love, right? I have no idea what they're talking about with each other or what's going on. So, like, I'm just like, and it's kind of, it's like, what is, you know, like, when people say that's a click, I just think it's one giant click. And if I could, but it just took me to probably last year to work out that, oh, every person in that click has a click with each other and then a click, and then it's always moving and I'm just like dizzy. Everything's always fluid with people, and that's a great thing. It's why we love them, but they're very difficult for me to understand in motion. I have to go back and have a think about it. I'm like, oh, that's what went on. So when you're a kid, though, like, your survival depends on how well you can do that. And girls on the spectrum do a thing called masking, which is you just do what you think is going on. You're not feeling it. You're not, like, you're feeling great anxiety and a genuine need to connect, but you're not doing it in the same way as people. You don't do the automatic thinking and the sharing of feelings. I have two feelings, good and bad, and that's it. And girls are mean. We know this. Like, I'm not saying anything new there. That's how we're sorting ourselves out and we grow out of it. We're not, this doesn't mean we're mean people. We're just sorting it out at school. But when you're different, that's not something I could have navigated or negotiated myself out of. So girls on the spectrum mask. So, and that's how I got my comedy chops. You know, they say you can't teach comedy. I disagree. It's called bullying. And it's the best teacher. It's a masterclass of comedy because it's, you know, like, you deflect attention. So what I would do is I'd just listen to conversations and then I'd, you know, store it up. And I freely admit I'm the master of the callback. And that was because of that time, because someone will say something. I'm like, oh, that's like the time someone said something else like that. And I'd make these connections and then people go, oh, you're funny and refreshing. And I'm like, I'm panicking.
Is that how you felt, like, listening to all of that? Because obviously I know what it's like to be in, like, a green room of a comedy club. That must have been, like, hellish for you.
hell, comedy, like, you know, there's this, you know, and people don't like comedy backstage.
No, that's absolutely true.
And the reason people don't like it is because people are still performing backstage. But I have real trouble reading that. And so I've upset a lot of, particularly males, because of the ego involved, bless them. It's not their fault. But they behave like they're really robust. So then I treat them like they're really robust. And then I hurt their feelings. And that's one of the... I have spent my whole life inadvertently hurting people's feelings, and it's what I've spent my life trying to avoid, because, like, if I want to hurt, you know, I know how to tear people a new asshole, but I don't like to.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason I do it is because either I'm misreading a situation or I really need to get out of it, and I'm creating a very firm me circle because I'm distressed. So, you know, sometimes I just, like, you know, that banter they always talk about. I thought I would join in, but sometimes I would just accidentally get the jugular or the nerve.
Right.
You know, like, I just wouldn't always know it.
Yeah.
And then I'd hear and go, so-and-so is really sad. Why?
It is often male stand-ups, but often with male stand-ups, they appear to be so robust on stage, and they're so willing to do kind of mean comedy and to never be the butt of a joke. Yeah, that backstage you can be like, well, you can take it. If you give it, you have to take it.
But I can see the difference between an on-stage persona and off-stage persona. What always catches me out is that they're still having a persona.
Mm.
Backstage, and it's mm-hmm. full of bravado, and I kind of believe it. But another thing I struggle with is, like, I can't take a joke. So if I I'm fine about me, you can say whatever you like about me. Like, I don't know whether it's like I just got copped enough, and
yeah,
I know, and it's not like, you know, because my mind's wired for patterns. There's absolutely nothing anybody can say to me that I haven't heard before or can't categorize into some other kind of thing that has nothing to do with me. So chiefly what I get is I'm fat and unattractive, which particularly when it comes from men is comical. Because it's like, I know how to hurt you. I'm going to withdraw my desire. It's like, ugh, can't take away what I don't want.
Yeah.
But, you know, they can in a way, because essentially we've been taught to believe that, you know, even men's attention is where you get places. And indeed it is. That's where I know it comes from. So I know it hasn't have any, like, this is cultural training. This has nothing to do with me. I don't have to really worry about what I look like. That's not something I have to deal with on a day-to-day level. I don't have mirrors. I brush my teeth. But who looks good when they brush their teeth? Nobody. And then I'm just trapped in my own little head. Like, that's how I experience the world. I don't experience it as how other people look at me. And that has meant that I don't always, you know, it's harder when you're young. Like, I think autism is like a slow bloom situation. Just takes us a long time to get our rhythm, and that's when the damage is done, because if you don't hit the points at the right time, if you don't develop in an order, that's when you're traumatized, because you're being forced to sort of develop in the right order, and the disappointment or the hostility or the, you know. Whereas it's a disorder, it doesn't mean we won't get the order in the end. But quite often, like, I had difficulty speaking, but I managed to hide that. So, you know, my mum knows that I got words mixed up and all that, but no one else really noticed, because I could, you know, I developed idiosyncratic speech, and I'd practice what I had to say. When I was younger, because I didn't have the catalogue in my head, when I was younger, I couldn't go into a conversation not knowing what I could possibly say. In the stress of social situations, the connection between my brain and my mouth would dissolve. There was no... So I would have to train myself to develop these neurological parts. And it wasn't just like knowing in my head what to say. I had to develop muscle memory around my, like how it would feel. Like, so it was, you know, a physical practice. So I would have stock phrases and, you know, and so I'd come across as being endearing little eccentric person. That had catchphrases and stuff. But what it is like, if I didn't, I couldn't speak.
And you didn't get a diagnosis until like 5 years ago?
Yeah, like, and this is why fucking films like Rain Man are so dumb, and why people are like, but it's called acting. It's not called acting. It's called neurotypical people deciding what autism is, so people with autism don't even recognize themselves. That's what it's called. So I got very little time for acting. Screw yourselves. I tried acting like a neurotypical person. Look where that got me. Often what people think of autism are a series of behaviors that are actually just coping mechanisms.
Mm.
You know, the rocking, the repetitive movements, even down to taking solace in patterns and, you know, the math of, you know, their special interest is a safety from a world that's really, really overwhelming, you know, and depending where you are on the spectrum, it can be, you know, damn right hostile. Like, you know, an airport, from what I understand, is a war zone.
Yeah. How did you find living in New York for so long?
There's a thing about New York that's kind of wonderful in that its chaos is predictable and people leave you alone. You can live in your own head bubble. And also, you know, it was that thing, you know, you ask people, they'll tell you. If they don't want to tell you, they won't tell you. And I don't find a problem in that. You know, if someone's mean, you know, go, you know, I don't want to talk to you. I'm like, I just treat that as a fact. I don't take it personally. I'm like, there's a person who doesn't want to talk to me. Okay, let's try this person. Whereas it's like, you know, there's that thing where people give you the impression they want to talk to you, and then you take that impression at face value, and then you find out later, and this is like, oh, I'm being annoying. They're just being polite. I don't like that one.
Right.
So, you know, New York is it gets to me eventually because it's noisy. Like, it's just. It's a physical noise, and I feel sound. There's a crossover there.
And what does that... Because I've heard people say that before. Is that like... I mean, I suppose you don't know what it's like to not feel it. So me asking what it's like might not make sense.
The best way... There's certain pictures that have physical ramifications in my body. So, you know, I've heard people describe synesthesia as like, you know, colours for things. Mm-hmm. And it's... That doesn't seem like... the nice world I live in. What I feel is like physical ramifications for sound, and most of them are in cities are unpleasant. The higher pitched tend to sort of have a sharpness in my spine that like I have to sort of brace, and you know, sirens can, you know, I've been floored by sirens going past, like, you know, doubled over, like. But it also depends on where my energy is. Like, if I'm, if I had enough sleep, if life's not already overwhelming me, I can get through. But what diagnosis did for me was to discover, you know, like, I understood that's what bad sounds did, but then I was able to weaponize good sounds, and that helped a lot.
But it's so frustrating that autism in girls is so much less diagnosed, because presumably once you have a diagnosis, it not having the thing is easier, but you can find ways to deal with it. You can, you know, create the world to suit you a little bit more in a way, or make your world feel like that.
That is absolutely the real frustrating thing about it, because the thing about autistic brains is by and large they're problem solvers. That's why it's like, I believe we have a place. Like, I don't believe that we need to be charity cases. Like, I honestly believe, you know, like, there's a place in this world where people who want to do the same thing every day, I think that's actually a good thing. I think, you know, there's a kid who used to work at my supermarket when I was growing up, and he was a trolley boy, and he loved that job, and he's on the spectrum, and he's still the trolley boy. Mm-hmm. And he's trolley man now. And it's just like, you know, I rate that. He's like, he's got his own thing going on. But the problem solving brain is a delight. Like, you know, that's what diagnosis has helped me. Like, of course, it would be different if I'd had been diagnosed earlier. You know, there's a complication with you know, people say, I don't like labels. And it's like, oh, God, labels are annoying if you have to live there, but they're a really handy starting point.
Yeah.
Like, labels are help. It's like, oh, I am different. You are different. Let's work from there. It's okay. It's like, if people's like, oh, I don't like labels, it's like, but I know I'm different. You know, the difficult thing I'm finding now is it's like, I still have to convince people that I'm on the spectrum. It was like Mark Maron just casually said, you can read, like, because he'd interviewed apparently someone who was really autistic was the words he used. And they said, because you can read social cues. And I'm like, it's like, because the proof is not, you know, enough.
Oh, that's so annoying. Were you tempted to be like, I'm sorry, my internet's going, I just can't hear you, we're gonna
What I said was, well, if you mean that I can read that you're being an asshole right now, yes.
Oh, good.
But that's not because I'm emotionally invested. It's because you're putting the proof down. But that's, I can do that. But most people on the spectrum don't get to do that.
Yeah.
Because people's understanding of it is not what it is.
I think you're saying, like, I quite like labels. When I realised I was gay and I was like, great, there are other lesbians. I understand that I'm a lesbian. I like hanging out with other lesbians. This makes sense. Great. Okay, good. I like that. I like that I know that there are other people that feel like me.
Yeah, the problem with labels comes when they become pigeonholes.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And not just a sequence of badges you wear.
I've got my badge on right now, you just can't see it. I mean, I'm wearing a Stonewall Inn t-shirt, so I'm really leaning into the cliche.
That I didn't give that what it deserved. In my head, I'm like, yeah, that's really funny. And all my face did just then was like, yep. So I'm sorry for that.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I like the directness. I know. I always know exactly where I am with you because you're so direct. So, and that's actually enormously refreshing for another stand-up.
Yeah.
Like, I remember you coming to one of my shows and you were like, I liked that. And I was like, I just don't think she'd lie.
I can't lie. And I can't do enthusiasm. Like, I can, but it just has to be, it's a rare, I can't manufacture extreme enthusiasm. So I can go from neutral to 90 with the same intonation.
You're saying that because I know that, like, I know that to be true from, like, spending time with you and being like, oh, I saw that you got a second Netflix special, and you were like, yeah, it's good. And it's like, if you spent any time with any other comic, they'd be like, you know, I've got another Netflix, like it would be the first, like, it's just, it's enormously refreshing.
I get, you know, and I want to reiterate, it's not about me being humble. It's about like where my brain wants to think about what it wants to think about. And it likes to think about solving problems. And sometimes I invent those problems. Sometimes they're just like, why is that door ajar? Like, who knows what it is. But getting a Netflix special is not a problem. It's great. So just leave it at that. Like, there's nothing else to be said. There's nothing else to think about. It's just good.
How does it feel now that you're like having had this conversation with you and knowing all of this stuff about you, about, you know, but how the world's sort of not set up for you in a way. How does it feel now that you're like famous?
In a sense, the celebrity life is really helpful because I mean, I'm used to walking in a room and people knowing who I am and I'm not knowing them, but that's called, like, forgetting who people are. Now it's...
So you've been famous forever. I just didn't realize.
Pretty much. but, you know, it's not so much that. It's just the just simply on in terms of being an artist, it means that I can channel my energies into solving creative problems, which is what I love to do and what I do well and what I hope I think I'm, you know, making a positive contribution with. But I've had a lifetime of struggle to draw from. I don't feel like, I still feel a little guilt that I don't struggle like I used to. And I know that there are so many people in the world struggling as much, if not more, as I used to, and I don't know what to do about that. But I also, I don't want to struggle. I don't want to, it nearly killed me. So I don't want to, you know.
Go back to that.
I don't want to. Like, I don't want, I'd rather quit comedy than hustle at Edinburgh again. Like, honestly, I just also feel like I've done it. Like, I've said my piece. I feel seen. I just don't feel like it defines who I am. It's what I really enjoy doing. But I enjoy solving problems. So problems are going to be everywhere. I don't have to make them up and then turn them into a story and put them on stage. That's just a real treat that I get to do at the moment. But rearranging furniture to fit a room, equally satisfying to me.
I like that. Like it's Tetris in your house. Like when it gets in all the right places, it disappears and you have to start again.
Yeah. The thing about... I have a manual brain, and so I'm clocking a room. I can walk into a room that I go into every day, and it's still a new room. I don't have automatic thinking. You know how you get used to how your house is? I don't. So I'm always just like, that just doesn't look right there. That doesn't. So I'm always just like moving things around.
Just constantly.
Yeah.
No, there's one more thing two more things if I can have 5 minutes of your time. The one thing I wanted to mention, and it's something that's come up a lot and something that, like, conversations that I've had amongst friends as well, and I was wondering how you feel about it, in that I feel like since you've sort of had Netflix specials and since you've been someone that lots of people are aware of, it feels like loads of gay women felt like they could see themselves in something that had, in a way that they never had before.
That was the story. The story I told, and that's why I had to tell it the way I did, and that's why I had to subvert comedy in order to tell it, is because it's not a story our cultures understand. The queer woman, the gay woman, the lesbian story is not the same as the male story. And we always just took the seat behind that story. And it just, in order to overcome trauma, you need to be able to have a narrative, not that just you can tell, but other people understand. And so I think the coming out story is different. It has different points. It has different dangers for different reasons. And I just, when I wrote Nanette, I just thought, I just don't think people understand. I just think they think this is sorted. And it has everything to do with gendered violence, that we don't get to just escape after society goes, okay, gay people are okay. We're still women, you know, and the same is true for, you know, the trans journey and more effeminate men. It goes beyond sexuality, and it sits in this difficult area of gendered violence that really has nothing to do with sexuality. But the coming out story, you know, of my generation, and it's just never been told in those terms. And
I just think it's so incredible that Nanette has done that.
Yeah.
And Douglas existing, and, you know, and it being like, I just think it's remarkable. Like, I feel like if I had seen you and that and been able to watch you on stage as a teenager, I would have been so much happier. And now that exists for others.
Yeah, I feel good about being able to, being responsible for that, you know, place where people can sort of live, exist in and see themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's all sorts of, as you know, contortions you have to do in order to see yourselves in our stories, you know, mm-hmm. cultural stories. And I just think with Nanette, it's something that people like us had to contort themselves less. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's why a lot of men got so angry with it, because they just didn't fit that story. They didn't know where they fit it in. They didn't understand it wasn't about them, but still they tried to make it about them. Good on them.
Okay, I've got one more question, and then I'll leave you to your day, and I'll go to bed, because that's how time works. I ask everyone this who comes on the show, and you can either think of like a younger version of yourself or maybe someone that's listening. If you had to give, like, I don't know, a nugget of advice, I'm not sure how you feel about giving advice, but if you had to either like a younger version of yourself or to someone that's listening, we have loads of listeners that are really young. Some of them are not out yet, or some of them are maybe in quite hostile homes or are finding it quite tough, especially in lockdown. If you could give them a bit of advice, what would you say?
I'd say, like, I don't know about practical advice. I'm not a practical person, but I would say that the pain you're feeling is worse because it's a one-sided conversation. If you're not being seen, then that's not your fault. But it's unfair. And that's, you just got to take solace in that as you keep fighting.
Perfect. Hannah, I think you're so fucking brilliant. I really do. I love what you do, and I've loved your shows for years and years. And so I really appreciate you taking the time to chat to me. Thanks, mate.
Thank you, Susie Ruffle. I'm at 90.
There it is. The brilliant Hannah Gadsby. Thank you so, so much for listening to the show. Those of you that are new listeners, because of Hannah being on the show, go back and have a listen to some of the other episodes. I hope that you'll enjoy some of those too. And to the regular listeners who are here every week, I love you guys too, don't worry. Okay, I'm going to say goodbye now. I'll see you next week with another episode, and you take care. Bye.